morning, Matt. How are you?
Hey, Jim. I'm doing great, man. How are things on your side of things?
Everything's hunky-dory, as they might say a long time ago.
Well, man, I am so happy you're doing these couple of shows with Kenny. Have you two started rehearsing yet?
No, actually, we start on the 10th, but we picked out a set that the band that's going to be there is mainly the band that I'm traveling with some augmentations. I'm bringing in the two horn players that did the Locks Messina reunions 2005 and 2009. I'm also bringing in Gary Oliar, who played violin on the 2009 tour. I'm bringing in David Beyer, who performed the PBS special Loggins and Messina when we did that for Kenny.
Wow.
And has done some other stuff with Kenny. And then I'll have, again, my keyboard player is James Frazier, and my bass player is Michael Brady, who I've worked with for a number of years. So we've been performing this material almost every night for the last 5-6 years. So most of it, with the exception of Ahivala, which we'll rehearse on the 10th. We'll get that up together. But the band is very comfortable with most of the material, so Kenny and I should be able to slip our voices in there fairly easily.
Oh, that's fantastic, man. And I got to tell you, I read Kenny's book, and I spoke to Kenny about the book. There is a moment at the end of the book, kind of the acknowledgement section, where he tells a great story. He says, Loggins and Messina were stuck in a snowstorm back in our early days as an opening act with an irate crowd in rural Maine, growing antsy for a headliner that would not show up, and rocks being thrown through our dressing room windows. I shout at Jim Messina, this is effed up, man. I didn't sign up for this. So he says, Jimmy calmly responded, yeah, this is a lousy way to make $1 million. I stood immediately corrected. And what I love about that, Jim, is it's kind of the classic version of, you know, I know us here in radio, like, we'll look at each other and go, we're not digging ditches. So in that moment, like, you already, like, had certainly been through enough in your career to recognize a situation that's terrible versus one that is like, you know what, maybe this is not ideal, but we'll get through it. And it, you know, it's good when you get that perspective early on as an artist.
Well, I think it's important at times. Most importantly is that all of us get emotionally caught up in things. And especially when you've been out on the road every day, every night, and you're traveling, you're not getting any sleep, and something crappy happens like that, it's very hard to, you know, to maintain one's perspective. But between you and I have dug ditches. So, you know, been there, done that. And again, you know, we just have to realize this is all a lot of hard work. And when we signed up for it, nobody told us we're gonna be wealthy people. But we do have commitments, and that's part of it, is hanging in there and living through it.
What kind of sticks with you? I mean, what's notable about these Hollywood Bowl shows is that these Hollywood Bowl shows come 50 years after playing that same venue, supporting the debut record. So what kind of sticks when you, what sticks with you when you think about that original tour?
Oh, golly. You know, I probably, of all people, should be someone who looks back. And not that I don't think that they should, but I'm so, in electronics, the word bias means, you know, negative electron flow, moving something in a direction and keeping it on course. And I think for me, my way in life, I have a bias toward moving forward. And I very seldom look back. And at this point in my life, since I'm still moving so quickly, when I look back at the Hollywood Bowl, I think of how wonderful it was for us to have had that opportunity to reach that level of success. And to do it twice in your life, I think is just super. I mean, I'm very honored to have had them offer that to us. So I'm looking forward to going there with, you know, at 74 as opposed to 24 or whatever it was in yeah. those days. Knowing that, you know, I still perform, you know, 40, 50, 60 dates a year. My voice is better than it ever has been. I think my playing has gotten better. And so I'm going to enjoy performing the material that Kenny and I created to the best of my ability to, I believe, an audience who's going to be very excited to hear it.
And when I spoke with Kenny recently, he talked about how much he had learned from you as a fellow artist. And you both are the same age. But as I referenced, at the time that you two came together, you already were so seasoned and had done so much in the business. You know, kind of flipping the script a little bit, what do you kind of think you learned as a result of your time with working with Kenny?
Well, Kenny gave me something that I did not have, was the ability to look at vocals and the things that you can do with vocals and your voice. And he added so much to the vocal arrangements on the Longest of Messina stuff and on my songs. I mean, I just recently, you know, went back and listened to Peace of Mind out of the trilogy that we did, preparing for the show. And he did such an incredible job on that song, and on the end especially, where he's improvising. And he just vocally brought new meaning to the song. And as I look back, and I think a lot of what he, if I might say, taught me or gave me was the ability to look at the vocals and find ways in which to use them, not only just as harmony parts, but as counterpoint and sounds. And he did, I did something for, I think it was Taylor Guitars, where I re-recorded the song I did on one of my albums called The Island, and we did it instrumentally. And he went in later after I had already recorded it and put in some vocals on it. And I was just reminded, a very gentle reminder of what an incredible instrument he has in his voice. And he definitely brought me up a notch, if not two, on production when it comes to vocal arrangements and using the voice. So I definitely could have not learned that without him.
And I know that he and his author like reached out to you in regards to the stuff about the band that's in this book. And he talked about how for him, writing about this stuff kind of brought up a lot of emotions he hadn't processed before. So I wondered, like, you know, so often when somebody does a book like this, you don't see any of it until it hits the shelves. So what did getting a chance to, you know, see this stuff kind of bring out for you, you know, when you kind of consider what you two had gone through in your time working together?
Well, I've only had a chance to just skim it, so I don't know totally what's in the book. Some of the stuff that I heard in there, or, you know, glanced through, is that I think at some point in time, there were things he just didn't understand about the business that I think probably today he would understand. Like, you know, you really can't interfere in other people's contractual relationships. Those are private negotiations. And both artists and companies and attorneys have that confidentiality and that kind of stuff. And I think that in retrospect, hopefully once he understands or learns that, especially if he gets involved in anything where, you know, you've got a separate person under a separate contract, there are just certain things you have to respect. And I felt bad for him because he felt like he was a victim in that. But again, these are things that we learn as we go through life, and especially when you're involved in negotiations, we have to accept and learn from.
All the other stuff that you've done, you only were with Poco for those first two records. I wondered how intense of a band it was to be in, because I don't think anybody knew that there would be these bands that would go on for decades. But I'm curious if you saw yourself initially being in Poco for the long haul.
I did. Initially, I did see that happening. What began to happen in Poco was frustration, and especially for Richie. He saw his partners, Neil Young and Steven, go on to become very successful. And I think it was very difficult for him and frustrating for him. And after a while, it weared on him to the point where it began to wear on me. And also what weared on me, which had nothing to do with him, is the fact that our music was just too country for rock stations and too rock for country stations. And I don't remember making more than $125 a week in the band, even though we sold out every show. We didn't sell any records. I had a wife that I needed to support. And that's at one point in time, because of that frustration that Rusty was feeling, sort of pouring it on me and other people in the band, I just thought, you know, it's time for me to maybe make a decision here to get off the road and start producing records full time, be home. And, you know, that was a choice that I felt that I needed to make. And, but I didn't want them to fail either. And that's why, you know, when I went to Clive Davis and said, hey, you know, I need to make a change. And, you know, he said, look, you know, finish production, you know, help them continue, you know, get a replacement. And once that's done, we'll talk about whether or not, you know, we could put you on as a producer. And that's what I did. I, you know, let them choose Paul Cotton, who I thought was an excellent choice. In fact, he and I roomed together for a couple of weeks before I finally left the band. And I helped him with the parts and get him going, and so that I could leave that knowing that I left them in a good shape with an album that was ready to release and somebody to replace me, so that they would not fall.
What was Clive Davis like in those days?
I liked working with Clive. He was, you know, he was a very strong willed minded person, but always objective, and I felt had reasonable suggestions. I remember at one point in time we had finished doing, I think it was the second album, and Thinking of You was on it, and I had recorded it acoustically. You know, and he said, I really think that this should have more of an electric feel. And of course, the frustrating thing is that this is already done, right? So he said, I really would like you to go back and re-record it. And I thought, okay, well, you know, he sees something here that I don't. But we went back, and I brought in some, I think it was a clavinet on it, and brought up the tempo and made it more electric and finished it. And I said, what do you think? And he says, I like it. So he released it as a single, and it actually did quite well. It wasn't as Your Mama Don't Dance, but it did quite well. And the name of the game is to sell records when you're talking about commercial. So I thought his guidance and his support was helpful. If he were more of a musician in terms of being a musician, that might have been even more helpful. But his instincts were always pretty right on, and he was very respectful of my creativity with Kenny. So, you know, I thought he was great to work with.
How gratifying was it to get a chance to put Poco back together, you know, kind of that initial lineup, including Randy, for the Legacy record?
Well, I look back at it and I realize it was a big job. And of course we had all changed. Richie had become a minister, so he was very hard to please when it came to lyrics and melodies. And so we had to figure out ways to, you know, accommodate his input. You know, and Randy, I just loved working with Randy. He's such a sweetheart. And, you know, most of all, I have to say that it was a great awakening for Rusty Young and I, because we, George was unable to be there. He had gotten ill. And, you know, Randy is a singer and a player. And Richie was living in Colorado. So basically, David Cole, the producer, Rusty, and I finished the record. And how wonderful it was to work with Rusty and get some of our guitar parts and solos and harmonies and finish the vocals. And it really reunited our friendship to where when I recorded the album, Jim Messina and the Groove, I invited him as a guest artist to come in and sit in. And I'm so glad he did, because we lost him last year. So I have him playing steel guitar on Kind Woman, Child's Claim to Fame, on Dobro, and steel on You Better Think Twice, and a couple of Largest Messina songs that I had written or was writing about the time I left Poco. So we had a chance to let the audiences see what those songs would have sounded like if they would have been Poco songs. And the other thing I'm glad I was able to help him with was that when we were doing that live album in the Groove, there was a guy in the audience, Blue Alon, the president of Blue Alon, and I had asked Rusty to sit in that show with the idea of maybe start thinking about doing a solo record, you know, because he hadn't been playing steel guitar up to that point. And so he was, you know, seen by this guy, the president, and later signed a deal with him. And so he did get that solo record finally, and he did get it released before his passing. And I'm just so glad I was able to to convince him to take that step, sit in, do this, and finally get his solo record deal, which he deserved.
Yeah, I really enjoyed listening to In the Groove, and like you highlight his instrumental talents. But something that I've spoken about a good amount with people recently is like, I just don't think there's anybody that sings like Rusty Young. Like, he's a really underrated singer.
Yeah, he is. And he was in a group called the
Sky Kings.
Sky Kings. And at his memorial, John Cowan wanted to play that song at the end. And I looked at him, I said, "Is that Rusty singing?" And he goes, "Yeah." I said, "Oh my God. That is, I just love that. He just did such a super job on it." Yeah, I agree with you. And I love his song I'm not Neil Young's brother.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Being an 80s nerd, I want to loop back briefly to Legacy and just ask you, what was the experience of putting Call It Love together?
Well, it wasn't our song. It was written by somebody else. But again, Richie did not want the song to come out because he didn't like the lyrics. So that created a problem. So I finally volunteered to see if I could help rewrite it lyrically to where it would work, which it finally did. We finally got it recorded. And the guitar solo was not mine. I did not write that. But it was so cool that I said, you know, I have got to learn this not only the way they did it, but I've got to find a way to make it mine and give it a sound that's going to be super. So it was so fun coming up with the guitar solo on that, because I used two two Boogie cabinets, one with a JBL and another JBL, which was a twin amp, and then I had a Marshall hooked to two other speakers, which gave the distortion, and then all the effects came out the other speakers on both sides in stereo, and there was just two mics way back in the room, and we turned it up and played the solo and mixed it however we could get that edge, get the distortion, get the effects, and it just came out fantastic.
That's awesome, man. Well, I want to wrap things up. You know, you talked about the In the Groove live record. Have you been writing at all? Like, do you see another studio record on tap at any point?
You know what? I have a lot of songs in the can that I have not released because I haven't been on a major label, and I'm in the process of talking to a couple of labels about a record deal.
Great.
I'm finishing up my control room here. So pretty soon we'll have the guys in there re-recording some new material and hopefully get a release. And hopefully right after the Jim Messina and Kenny doing the Hollywood Bowl, which is July, 15th?
Yeah, 15th and 16th of July, yeah.
Yeah, I'll probably take that time between after that time and the 1st of August to actually wrap up that control room and start getting in there and recording again.
Awesome, Jim. This was a lot of fun. Folks can go to jimmessina.com to find everything that you've got going on, including those Loggins and Messina shows, July 15th and 16th at the Hollywood Bowl. You've got some shows of your own on either side of that, man. And it was a real pleasure to speak with you. I appreciate the time.
You bet. And thank you very much for taking the time to do the interview.